You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Justin Wong toku ingoa. Nau mai haere mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā, te rā te kaumawhitu o Hui Tanguru. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Monday Rahina, Monday the 17th of February. I'm Justin and I will be here with you for the next hour alone in the studio. In case if you're wondering anything is happening, Sherry is away this week to achieve her dream. She'll be back tomorrow on The Wire as well, while my producer James Tapp is also away, but he left a piece for me and for you all as well. And let's get into business. Coming up on the show today, as usual with Monday, I spoke with Green Party co-leader James Shaw about the emissions trading scheme, the government's homeless housing package, and public broadcasting. James talked to a law academic at Otago University about the Sir Bob Jones defamation case. Rachel Simpson talks to Auckland Action Against Poverty's Ricardo Menendez March about the government's homeless housing package. Chris McCaddle spoke with Auckland councillor of Filipina about a new shelter for homeless women at the City Mission. And finally, I talked to Paul Tolich of Etu Union about New Zealand versus admission that it took photographs of two journalists. As always, here, aha o whakaro. If you have any thoughts to share throughout the show, we would love to hear from you. To kapatihi mai, you can do so by sending a text to 53995 or wai mai rane, call us in studio 309-3879. And let's go to see what's happening in Wellington.
It's time to hear from the Green Party with co-leader James Shaw.
Yes, we have our regular chat with Green Party co-leader James Shaw, and this week we talked about changes being made to the emissions trading scheme and the Greens' thoughts on the government's marquee homeless housing package last week, as well as the future of public broadcasting. But first, I asked him to explain why the scheme is changing.
Well, so the bill is actually currently in select committee. So it's about halfway through its parliamentary process. The main change, and the most significant one, is that we're actually putting in place a total cap on the amount of pollution that's allowed to go into the atmosphere. So the emissions trading scheme was designed, what they call it, a cap and trade system, but the problem is that previous governments didn't put an actual cap on it. And so that's one of the reasons why it hasn't done the job that it was supposed to do of actually reducing New Zealand's greenhouse gas emissions. So we're bringing in a volumetric cap, and then a bunch of other changes that kind of relate to how you then distribute kind of units within that cap. And then the idea is that that cap will come down over year by year into the future until we hit our target.
But why is this? Are these changes being made? Are we emissioning too much carbon into the atmosphere?
Yes, absolutely. We're emitting way too much pollution into the atmosphere, and we have been for some time. And our emissions have actually been going up rather than going down. And that the whole point of an emissions trading scheme is to, you know, help to bring your emissions down. And we've had this emissions trading scheme for about 10 years now, but because the previous governments, particularly the last national government, put in place a group of settings that really did, in many ways, gut the effectiveness of the scheme, what we're doing now is a major set of reforms that kind of take it back to what it was originally designed to do.
And the Parliamentary Environmental Commissioner, Simon Upton, told Stuff today that he says these changes did not go very far enough and they are too corporate friendly. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, look, I've seen Simon Upton's comments, I think, you know, amongst all of the submissions that we've received, we should be paying particular attention to what it is that he says. So I've yet to get advice on the changes that he is proposing, but I'll certainly be looking forward to getting that from the Ministry for the Environment.
Good. And let's move on to a government marquee policy announcement last week, the homelessness housing package. So now $300 million is being spent by the government on housing for the homeless. What are the Greens' thoughts on this?
Well, absolutely delighted with this particular package. It's only one part of the overall jigsaw puzzle, and we absolutely need to go, you know, much further than we have been going and move a lot faster than we have. But the bit of the jigsaw puzzle that announcement last week deals with is about 3,000 people, roughly, who live in motels. The previous government's solution to homelessness was to put people into motels. And they were spending about $200 million a year, something like $120 million of which was basically paying the motels to accommodate these families. And so what the package announced last week does is actually we're taking people out of those motels and we're putting them into proper homes. And so that's what we should have been doing all along. And ultimately, actually, that's cheaper for the government and it gives those families a much better start.
But why not the funds? I know there's like $300 million to transitional housing, but why not use the money to build more state housing instead?
The thing is, we are actually also doing that, right? So we've built something on the order of 3,000 state houses over the course of the two and a half years that we've been in government. That's another piece of the jigsaw puzzle, is ensuring that there's adequate public housing supply. And again, 3,000 is a pretty small kind of dip your toe in the water against the scale of the problem that we inherited from the previous government. But the momentum on that state house building program is really starting to pick up pace. And you know, I don't know if you saw this, but recently there was another headline saying that there are now more houses being built than at any time in the last 70 years. And so it's going to take a while for those to come on stream, but you know, things are starting to move in the right direction, and that's because of the decisions and the actions that we've been taking over the last 2 years.
Apart from housing, is the government going to do more for the homeless? What are the other things that the government are going to do for the homeless?
Well, I guess the main thing around homelessness is what we call housing first. So this is to say, look, you know, people who are homeless suffer from a variety of issues, and particularly including kind of mental health. They need financial support and so on. But the most important thing is to get them into secure accommodation, a place that they can call their own, that they can rely on. That then alleviates an enormous source of stress and pressure. And then what you do is you wrap all those other services around and kind of support people to be into a position where they're able to stand on their own two feet again. And so that's not a new idea. It's been really successfully implemented overseas, and our government brought it in about a sort of last year or the year before, I can't quite remember exactly when, and have been slowly building that up. And actually, that's behind this move between, you know, getting people out of motels and into kind of proper homes, is that we're then able to provide those other services in a way that actually works, because it's against the background of people knowing that they've got somewhere to live.
Cool. And final topic for today, I would like to talk about public broadcasting. Now, Broadcasting Minister Chris Farfoy announced around 2 weeks ago that the government is going to have a business plan to merge TV NZ and Radio New Zealand together. So I'm just wondering what the Greens expect to see from this public media reform.
Well, we are looking to the business case, which is essentially what Minister Farfoy announced, was that we would move to the next stage, which is a much more in-depth business case development. And, you know, what we want to do is make sure that the principle of public service broadcasting is maintained in the merger, and that it isn't kind of yanked awry by the need to make a profit, which is, I think, one of the issues that we've got with the TVNZ model over the RNZ model. And so what we want to really make sure is that that kind of high-quality public broadcasting ethos is carried through. And so we'll kind of be keeping an eye on that to make sure that that principle is preserved.
I spoke to the New Zealand Māori Council about this last week, and what they said, apart from big media brands like TVNZ and RNZ, Māori and iwi radio and broadcasting needs funding to update its structure and put more Māori interest into programming in public media. I'm just wondering, has this been raised in cabinet discussions on reforming public media?
Well, to be honest with you, not in the conversations I've been a part of, but that doesn't necessarily mean that it hasn't happened. And I know that there is a live conversation in the government about how we support Māori media.
But what about your personal thoughts on this?
Well, look, I would tend to agree. I think that the various Māori iwi radio stations, Māori television, do a fantastic job. And they do it on the smell of an oily rag, and should be well supported, because we know that the media landscape is going through nine kinds of chaos at the moment, and we absolutely want to make sure that, again, that public service broadcasting ethos that the Māori radio and TV stations offer is maintained into the future.
Green Party co-leader James Shaw, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me on the show.
That was James Shaw for the Green Party.
The Wire.
Ko te Wire tēnei maronga BFM. That was me talking to Green Party co-leader James Shaw about the emissions trading scheme, housing for the homeless and public broadcasting. We will be back after a quick break. Here is The Barrel by Aldous Harding.
Appearance of cockadady said, show the ferret to the egg, I'm not getting let alone.
Do you like yummy food?
You're not going to ask me if I'm a dick?
Why? Do you think you're a dick?
Nah, just like last time we did this.
Treat your tum this summer with the Lucky Taco Fiesta Kit. Everything you need to make Lucky Tacos at home in just 10 minutes. Tasty, spicy, fresh, Lucky Tacos make you feel good. So why not make it a ritual? Pick up a Lucky Taco Fiesta Kit at your local Faro Fresh or get free delivery direct from the HQ at theluckytaco.co.nz.
Auckland Transport is making improvements to Tāmaki Drive between Key Street and the Ngāpipi Bridge starting early February. We are extending the cycleway from Key Street up to the Ngāpipi Bridge and will also be raising the height of the road in some sections to protect against flooding. During the works, drivers may experience delays on Tāmaki Drive during peak travel periods. If you can, travel outside peak hours. AT thanks you for your patience while we do this important work. For more information, head to at.govt.nz.
Sorry, no goths.
Excuse me?
Yeah, piss off. Maybe without those sunnies you could read the bloody sign.
No goths? This is cruel and unusual.
Not as cruel and unusual as that beautiful velvet cape. Now get out of my sight, Nosferatu.
I'm a human being.
It's hard out there for a goth, but everyone's welcome on Penny's 1 to 4. A heady mix of the sounds of now and the shimmering hits from our alternative past. To four with Penny this afternoon only on 95 BFM.
Irirangi Pō, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire. Now, last week, Sir Bob Jones filed a defamation case against filmmaker Rene Mahi after she started a petition against him due to an NBR article on Waitangi Day 2 years ago. The article suggested Waitangi Day should be changed to quote-unquote Māori Gratitude Day, where Māori should bring pākehā bed and breakfast in bed. The case was supposed to last 2 weeks. Instead, Jones withdrew after 2 days after admitting he never read the petition within court. James talked to Marcelo Rodriguez Ferreira from the University of Otago about the case and what could have happened.
So what were the possibilities if the case had continued?
Well, the possibilities of the case continuing was either that Bob Jones or his opponent would win. One of them was going to win, one of them was going to lose. Yeah, it's as simple as that, really.
What would have happened if Sir Bob had lost the case?
If he had lost the case, it would have been a pretty much the similar situation we've got now. So when you lose a case in a situation like this, the other side, the winning side, I guess, in this case, the defendant, has the opportunity to apply for something called costs. Now, costs seems like you get sort of the costs of actually bringing the appeal or bringing the case, and all your lawyer's fees all paid for. But it works a little differently like that. You get about two-thirds of your actual costs that were expended. So regardless of what had happened, she would have been out of pocket just for defending the case.
So then now who will be paying the court fees?
Jones will basically presumptively be liable to pay her costs. But as I say, it's unlikely that all of her costs are going to be paid for by him. The court has the ability to order that, but it's only in the most rare of cases that occurs. It might happen in this case because at the same time he discontinued or withdrew the case at a point where it was pretty clear from everybody that was watching that he really didn't have a chance of winning it. And so you could probably argue that because it was almost a vexatious case being brought, she may have some claim to a higher amount of costs that she would otherwise have received. But the general point is that it was a colossal waste of time and money for her, but also the system, and most of that's not going to be recouped.
Now, would there have been any possibility that Sir Bob Jones would have lost his knighthood?
Not from this case. So honoraria sort of knighthoods and damehoods are within the discretion of the Crown, and there is a process for awarding them. There's not much of a process for removing them. To my knowledge, that's never happened before. But certainly losing a case like this is wholly unconnected with the actual process of awarding or removing such a title. He was suing her for defamation, and that's a sort of a fundamentally different sort of idea than the petition that's still going on. I mean, he could still lose the knighthood as a result of the petition that I believe is still sort of gathering signatures, and probably, ironically, probably more signatures now that he brought the case than otherwise would have received.
Would this case have still been going ahead if Sir Bob Jones had actually read the petition in the first place?
That's a good question. It was surprising that he admitted that. It's not critical for his case of defamation that he did do that. It's not so a requirement that you've actually read the publication that has been alleged that has allegedly defamed you. But it did go to show that he was sort of launching this case without really all of the facts and potentially for all the wrong reasons. And certainly it bolstered her case she had any number of defences against his claims. From the get-go, I thought that this had no possible chance of succeeding, and I expect that his lawyers were pretty much of the same opinion and basically told him halfway through that the writing was on the wall, especially after sort of relatively bizarre sort of testimony that he gave to the court in the last couple of days.
And what sort of effect has this had on NBR's reputation, seeing as they are the publication that put out his article?
Yeah, that's a good question. I guess it throws into light as to whether or not he ought to be a columnist, and I believe that he has been since dropped from the publication as a columnist. I think that's right. But in any case, it just goes to show that it's not really sufficient for major publications to have a host of columnists and for them to basically say, well, it's their opinion and we are simply sort of running a range of opinions and it's really nothing to do with the newspaper. This has a lot of sort of knock-on effects and sort of they will rightfully have their reputation be scrutinised because the original column was just horrendous. The petition that resulted was justified, in my opinion. And his actions in suing the petition organiser was just odd, bizarre, really, more than anything else. And NBR would be presumably, hopefully, thinking that it would be a mistake to keep him on or as to even put him as a columnist in the first place.
Sweet. Are there any other comments you'd like to make?
No, beyond this is just a really bizarre case that has occurred, and I'm glad that he withdrew, and I really hope that she gets as much awarded against him as possible, because it goes to show just how possible it is to use civil litigation in this way as a sword and to really sort of dampen down what is ultimately justifiable free speech and reaction to his incendiary comments.
That was James Tapp talking to Marcelo Rodriguez Ferreira of Otago University about the Bob Jones defamation case against Rene Mahi. Don't forget, you can also let us know your thoughts on this story or other thought on your opinions on other stories as well. You can do so by texting us on 5395 or call us on 309-3879. And now,
I'm disappointed by the government these days. Sometimes they just need a good kick in the backside.
The Wire.
Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern opened the Auckland City Mission's new centre for homeless women last Thursday. The new facility would provide a safe haven and services for vulnerable women for up to 12 weeks and help them into more permanent accommodation. The property contained 15 self-contained units and would be able to provide shelter for 60 people a year. My producer Chris McCarroll talks to Auckland councillor Alf Filipina to find more.
So, just to start things off, do you want to describe the issue of homelessness in Auckland, how you see it?
For me, too many people homeless, which means they're sleeping in sometimes very dangerous situations, and we need to do something.
Cool. So do you also think that there are any particular issues that homeless women face that put them kind of in need of different support than the rest of the homeless population?
Yes, I do, because obviously they're more vulnerable. And look, from my perspective, I just don't want anything to happen, not only to the people who are sleeping on the streets, but in particular our women. Definitely. I believe that they're more vulnerable, and that's what we don't want to happen.
So do you just want to now describe what the new city mission facility is involves and the reasoning behind it?
Well, the vulnerability is the reasoning behind it, and having our woman in a safe place. So, you know, that's one of the key things in regards to this. And, you know, like always, I just acknowledge the launch and the initiative in regards to it. But, you know, that's one of the key things is having a safe place for our woman to be in regards to our te whare hina tore. So, you know, that's it for me. It's just if we can end up putting them as in our woman and our community, especially our woman, in a stable environment, roof over their heads. Look, I have no doubt at all that our agencies will be working with them to hopefully not to get them in that situation again where they're on the street. You know, that's really it's all about our women and the homelessness.
So obviously the government has recently announced some new spending for homelessness on a national level. How, obviously the government has announced new spending for homelessness on a national level. So how is this, what are your thoughts on the government's new homeless package and how will it help you in local governance?
Well, I mean, it'll help, obviously, for Auckland as one of the councillors in the Auckland region. It'll help in regards to our homeless action plan that we currently have. It will help with the agencies that are working with our communities who are homeless. You know, Housing First, for example, Salvation Army. So, look, welcome the package. I mean, you know, that this is something that has government, that has local government, that has our agencies, our non-government organisations, you know, our community. It just allows the fund allows even more help that can be given to our most vulnerable, which is our homeless. So I welcome it. Thank you to the government.
In addition to this new facility, what else is Auckland Council doing to alleviate Auckland's problems with homelessness?
Well, I mean, look, when we mentioned housing first, I mean, look, there's an organisation that looks at housing our homeless. And, you know, for us, that's been in operation for the last 2.5 or even the last term around it. So, look, we're playing our part in Tāmaki Makaurau around our homelessness. You know, we've put money towards that as well to help our agencies. So, you know, that's the ability to have the people that our agencies are working with to end up putting them into shelter, albeit temporary, but getting our community around them, our agencies around them, and hopefully get them out of the situation that they find themselves. So, you know, Auckland Council is there supporting not only financially but from an administrative perspective as well. So, you know, we're trying to work with our communities to make it better for the to our community, our people who find themselves in the situation they do.
Do you think that Auckland Council is doing enough at the moment to tackle the problem of homelessness?
Well, you can never do enough. That's one of the key things that everybody knows. You can never do enough enough to help our community, but we are playing our part that we can, and this is why welcoming the $300 million, albeit across the region, that the government has put in and announced, plus also the shelter that they have done for our women. So look, it's never going to be enough, but we are playing our part, definitely.
How do you see, or what personally would you like to see in the future for Auckland Council to do to further tackle homelessness?
Well, look, for me is working with all our agencies. Our agencies in Tāmaki Makaurau, and as I said earlier, Chris, not only government agencies, but non-government agencies and organisations. That's what I want to see in future. And we're doing that around a concerted coordination around that for our vulnerable communities that find themselves in the situation. So in the future, look, working with central government, working with our agencies and working with our community, that's exactly what I want to see moving into the future, especially in the next sort of year to 3 years, definitely.
That was Chris speaking to Auckland Councillor Alf Filipina about the City Mission's new homeless shelter for women. Before we proceed, we just got a text. It says, staff reported last Friday that the petition against Bob Jones was being closed by Renee Mahi herself. Her statement in court was, quote-unquote, "I intend to close the petition." I would like to clarify that because when James spoke to Otago University's Marcelo Rodriguez Ferreira, it was last Friday afternoon when the court was still in session, so we have missed that. But still, keep the texts and calls coming in. You know the numbers, 53954 for texts or 309-3879 if you want to call in. And speaking of housing for the homeless in the previous piece,
Why should New Zealanders care so much about this?
Because your children will curse you if you don't.
The Wire.
The coalition government last week has announced that $300 million will go towards combating homelessness in Auckland. The package involves providing less temporary housing, funding to sustain tenancies, solutions for Māori, and a well-being package for children in emergency housing that involves money for transport and education. Rachel Simpson talked to Ricardo Menendez-March from the Auckland Action Against Poverty about what the plan entails and what the critics might be.
So the $300 million package announced is primarily going to go into building more transitional housing. And transitional housing is a place that people that are waiting for permanent public housing go to. They can stay there for 3 months and then they have to renew it every time. And they face a lot of punitive obligations, such as continuously looking for a private rental or else they'll get threatened to be kicked out and they don't have a tenancy agreement. So it's a bit of a band-aid solution, but it's at least better than sleeping in a car. And then there is a bit of money being provided to Kaupapa Māori programs, which is good. But of course, what we would like to see is that amount being a lot larger, because we know that Mana Whenua are already doing a lot of the grassroots work, and what they're lacking often is resourcing.
So what is your main critiques? What's your main problems with the plan?
So the main problem is that, you know, we're seeing these PR exercises of small injections of cash. I mean, $300 million sounds maybe like a lot for an ordinary person, but in terms of government budgets, it's not a lot. And what we should be seeing is money going into permanent public housing to house all those 14,000 families on the waiting list in the next, you know, 2 to 3 years, ideally, because these are families that have kids that are growing up in unhealthy, unsafe situations. And then there's also the element of the announcement that includes people being charged 25% of their income on motels and emergency housing.
But how can they pay the 25% if they're homeless?
Well, that's right.
And, that's the issue, and so, I guess.
That's right. And so the government is conflating, quite frankly, what the difference between emergency housing and permanent public housing. When you go into emergency housing, it's a seven-day arrangement with a motel or a provider. You don't have a tenancy agreement. You don't have any rights as tenants, compared to when you go into public housing, where you actually have a tenancy agreement, and that means it's your place and you get charged income-related rent. And so the problem is that by introducing a 25% weekly income charge for these motels, what you're doing is you're creating further hardship, because these beneficiaries and low-income homeless families are not going to need a food grant from work and income to cover basic expenses in a place where they, again, have no rights. Often it's unsuitable and unsafe. And it's almost like we're punishing our homeless whānau and telling them that, like, they're the cause of the housing crisis, when really it's being successive governments that have not built enough public housing. So this is a step in the wrong direction. And I'm very surprised about this move by the government.
Do you think it's more positive than what's been done in recent years? So it's sort of well-meaning, or is it ultimately just temporary solutions?
Yeah, I mean, I think the problem is that compared to the previous government, of course this government is doing more on housing, but that's a very, very low bar. I mean, the previous government was selling state homes and didn't even acknowledge there was a housing crisis. And I think the situation is so bad that we should not be settling for a government that is just doing a little bit and a little bit too late, right? I think in order to end homelessness, we should be demanding the government to build enough public housing to treat our homeless communities with dignity. And I don't think that's a radical thing to ask. I think this is about recognizing that housing, at the end of the day, is a human right, and we should treat it as such.
What would be a better way to use the $300 million? I mean, to me, that's a lot of money. Yeah, was there a way to use that money for better, or is it different than just money injections?
The problem is not so much the injection of cash. I mean, in theory, you know, we should be having literally billions of dollars more going into public housing. We just had an infrastructure announcement a few days ago where $5 billion are going into building roads. And so when we know the government has the resources to ramp up the building of state housing, that could be doubling or even tripling the build. Treasury has said that this is, you know, that there are resources available to do this. And so what is really lacking is political will. It's not that the $300 million is a bad thing in itself. It's just that it's not enough. And it's kind of concerning from a frontline perspective to see the government doing this massive PR exercise, you know, putting all these resources into getting media to, you know, to show them all the stuff they're doing around the housing crisis, when really this does not go far enough and the government is not committing on building enough public housing. And that's kind of the bit that for those of us working with homeless communities, it's quite frustrating, because we know that at the end of the day, unless we see those solutions, they're just managing homelessness. They're not actually ending homelessness.
Yeah. Any extra comments? Any more comments?
Yes, yeah, so I think what we have an opportunity this budget is to see the government funneling resources into ramping up the build of public housing. And if they don't do that, I think it is going to be an indictment of this government not taking the housing crisis seriously enough. And so I'll be keeping my eye on budget announcements, and I think that will be the opportunity for this government to prove that they're committed to ending the housing crisis.
Ricardo Menendez-March from Auckland Action Against Poverty talking to Rachel Simpson about the government's homeless housing package. Menendez-March has also been selected as the Green Party's candidate at the Maungakiki electorate in this year's election. Kei te whakarongo koe ki te waia maronga irirangi poho. We will be back after break. But now here's the breaks by Warpaint. You are on the BFM with Justin.
relationships with their girlfriends or their wife. No one, they shouldn't have more than one wife at a time.
And finally for today, New Zealand First Leader Winston Peters admitted last week on Magic Talk Radio that they were responsible for taking photographs of journalists who are investigating the New Zealand First Foundation. Guyon Espinar from Radio New Zealand as well, and Mash Shand from Stuff, as well as former New Zealand First President Lester Gray. The photographs and a video were posted on the BFD, a whale oil-linked website which has been running stories defending New Zealand First and trying to belittle reporting about the New Zealand First Foundation donations. I talked to Paul Tollich, Ed2's Senior National Industrial Officer, about this revelation's potential harm to press freedom in New Zealand.
The union's position on anything related to the tracking or photographing or following journalists when they are in pursuit of a story and of general reporting is absolute opposition, because we believe in a free society that journalists are able to go about their duties without harassment by anyone, as long as they're within the law of the land, which they are. So it's of great concern to us, because the principles of journalism is that you report the news without fear or favour, without any political bias at all. And the union will always speak out on any matters relating to the freedom of journalists to go about and do their work and to express in the various media that they're working for the results of their investigations and their work. So that's our main concern. So we always speak out on any matters, because it's most important that you always speak out on matters relating to journalistic freedom. Because if you're not forever vigilant, and that is, as they've always said over the generations, vigilance is the price of liberty. And in a society where more and more of the political establishment throughout the world is trying to hamper the work of journalists, we're most concerned that here, where we have very good press freedom, that we would have this incident occur. That's basically our position. It's the reporting of the world and its events, and the following up of news stories and investigations is without fear or favour, and it is the work through the ages of journalism.
Now with this revelation, how could these type of harassments could damage New Zealand's freedom of press?
Well, I think that any curtailment of the freedom of press does undermine our democratic, values and the right to free expression. So, it's just every time we see an incident, we call it out and bring attention to it, and make sure that it's brought to the light of day and that the message is sent that this is unacceptable behaviour. That's very much, our position on this.
The Prime Minister herself has been quite silent about this issue. What do you think she should have done?
It's really not our position to comment on the Prime Minister or other members of the government. We're just basically making the statement and calling it out. And I'm sure that the message that we've expressed and views, are ones that will be given consideration by all the political parties. Not going to comment on. We don't really want to comment on all the of the politics of it and surrounding it. We just want to say this is not acceptable, and we want to make sure that it stopped, you know, this early in the, you know, the beginnings of the, you know, what's going to be a general election campaign.
I'm quite interested in one thing after this revelation. Is, are there any rules to protect, are there any laws or rules to protect journalists from on doing their work from being harassed?
I couldn't offhand answer that, but there's the there's various sections of the human rights that allow people to freely express their views. So in the Bill of Rights, that is where it is. There's no actual, you know, regulations. There's case law, and there's common law rights. But we don't have a constitution, and we're never keen on having law, you know, specific laws on it, other than in our constitutional framework of the Bill of Rights, etc., because legislation, you know, can easily be changed one way or the other, and various governments at times where they've had legislation have then amended it to tighten up the press laws. So it's part of our democratic, you know, sort of values of our society.
That was The Wire.
Ko rate ho taka katoa mo tene wiki, ne te mihi ki a koutou katoa I karero me ki o mo tene ra. That's all for The Wire for today, rahina Monday the 17th of February. Thanks to those who spoke with us for the show today. We got the Green Party's James Shaw, Marcelo Rodriguez Ferreira of Otago University, Ricardo Menendez-March of Auckland Action Against Poverty, and Paul Tollich of Atu Union. Also, a big thank you to my producers James Tapp, Chris Mikado, and Rachel Simpson. Neira hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongo ana. Thank you, and most of all, thank you to all of you who tuned in. Ka hoki mai mātou a te rawiki. We will be back next week. Sherry will be with you again tomorrow for The Wire. James also will be back next Monday, and I will move back to Tuesday. Penny is here with you for the next 3 hours for the 1 to 4. You're listening to 95BFM. Enjoy your week. Mate wa.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.